Hello, podcasting them softly listeners. This is Kent Hill, my guest tonight. You've probably heard that he's a little bit of a hellraiser, but he's really from the tribes of the moon. Yes, God is an astronaut and Oz is over the rainbow, but Midian is where the monsters live. And it's where my guest hails from, Midian. His name is Kinski. Kinski, of course, is a character played by the most excellent, the most eloquent Nicholas Vince.
Have you always loved movies or the theatre or acting or?
I was a show off,
right,
when I was a kid. I literally started at primary school doing school plays. And then just carried on into amateur theatre when I was about 11. My English teacher, we used to do public speaking things at school. I remember she encouraged us to do that, where you had to learn a piece and just stand up in front of an examiner and just say your piece, basically.
Right.
She belonged to the local amateur society. And they needed a boy to play the parts in a Dickensian evening. So I played Pip and I don't know if I played Oliver. I can't remember playing Oliver Twist. But basically it was an evening of extracts from Dickensian theatre. So that's kind of where I started. And I was doing amateur shows right up until I went to drama school. When I was 21 when I went to drama school.
Right.
So I was doing all those kind of things.
Right. Shakespeare and all that?
Say again?
Shakespeare?
Do you know, did I do any Shakespeare? I don't believe I did.
Right.
No, I don't. I mean, I love Shakespeare.
Right.
I always, you know, the moment I came across Shakespeare, I always thought he was brilliant.
Right.
And I loved the language. I loved the fact that it was all in the wrong, you know, all the words were in the wrong order. and I was mesmerized by this stuff. And when I was, I think back in the 1970s, so when I was a teenager, the BBC did all the Shakespeare plays. They dramatized all the Shakespeare plays. They got, you know, the top line actors. Janet Susman, I remember, and they did these shows. And what I found fascinating was the fact that the people you thought of as comedians, you're familiar with John Cleese?
Yes, you're also the Fawlty Towers.
Yeah, Monty Python,
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah.
He was. Basically in The Taming of the Shrew, he played the guy taming the shrew, and I can't remember the character's name.
Right.
And I just remember him doing this soliloquy to a candle, and it was absolutely mesmerizing. And I noticed that the comedians were able to make the language more accessible than the more classical actors. I mean, they were great.
Yeah.
But I was absolutely fascinated by the fact that comedians.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think I did until I got to drama school. When I was at drama school, I played Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet.
Right. As
a drama school production. But apart from that, I think that's probably the only Shakespeare I ever did.
Yeah. You know, you just mentioning it there, as you said, the soliloquy to a candle. You know who I saw who was absolutely, who I didn't know was that incredible an actor, because I'd never seen him on stage, I'd only seen him in films, and he usually played like the second baddie from the left.
Uh-huh.
And that was Stephen Burkoff. You know Stephen Burkoff?
Oh God, yeah, no, Stephen Burkoff. I've never had the pleasure of seeing him on stage.
Yeah.
I've read some of his work, and he was really active when we were at drama school and everyone.
Yeah.
Burkoff is amazing.
Yeah, he did a play, went all around the world with it. It was called Shakespeare's Villains, where he plays, does little segments of just the villains, like Iago and Richard III, and you know, all that sort of thing. And it's just these little, how should we say, like these, just these little, not the whole play, just little vignettes.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, for I think actors are wonderful anyway, but to be on stage with no props and to hold an audience's attention for 2 hours with nothing, he was, it blew my mind. Like, you watch him in films, like in Rambo, he's in a Rambo movie, and he was in a James Bond movie, and he was a bit part player in Stanley Kubrick films. But to see him do that just completely changed my impression of the man totally, because he blew the audience away just on stage.
I can imagine. I mean, I think over here he was known as a stage actor than anything else, because he wrote his own stuff. And again, funny enough, he has this amazing use of language that was very Shakespearean. I remember when we were doing our exams at drama school for stage fighting, a couple of the lads took a piece from one of his plays, which I want to call East, off the top of my head, which is basically East End Cockneys, villains, and so on. And the use of language is just purely Shakespearean. It's all written in rhyme, and it's extraordinary. Absolutely amazing actor.
Right, yeah. No, just when you talked about that soliloquy, you made me think of it. Because just to have, a lot of actors, you know, as you know yourself, you can have very little and command so much from an audience with, you know, the look in your eyes or the way you deliver a line or something like that. But to hold an audience for that length of time with none of the paraphernalia that is associated with a theatrical performance, you know, and just him alone... And I think the only thing that really changed during the performance, the lights for each vignette, the lights were a different color. Like when he did Macbeth, the light was red. When he did The Merchant of Venice, it was yellow. When he did Hamlet, it was white, a white light.
Right.
Yeah, and that was all. So if I don't know if he would ever go on tour again, but if he ever does, and you see Shakespeare's villains. Check that out. That's a cracker of a show. It really is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I shall definitely keep a look at that and eye out for that.
But anyway, enough about Stephen and more about you. was film the natural progression, or did you happen upon it by chance or opportunity or... You know,
I think it's opportunity, basically. When I was at drama school, I was at drama school with Simon Bamford, who plays Butterball in Hellraiser.
Right, right.
And Clive Barker, funnily enough, saw Simon do Shakespeare.
Wow, okay.
Because Simon and I were in the same year, but we were in different groups. So Simon was playing the fool in King Lear.
Right.
And Clive saw Simon do that and invited him to become part of his Clive's fringe theatre company called the Dog Company, which had Doug Bradley in it, and Pete Atkins, I think, was part of it, Oliver Parker, who plays the removal man in Hellraiser.
Right.
They were all part of it. Funny enough, Oliver Parker went on to direct Othello.
Right.
With Lawrence Fishburne playing.
Yes.
And Ken
Branagh plays Iago in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and then I think through Simon I got invited to a party. I met Clive. He asked me to model for him, so I modelled for Clive. As everyone knows, I'm sure, Clive is an amazing artist, and he illustrated the covers to an edition of the Books of Blood.
Right.
And, you know, six covers, and I feature, I think, on three of them.
Right.
Or bits of my body, certainly, feature on small, come to think of it. But there's a beautiful portrait of me with my head opened up and my brain's visible,
right.
And syringes dropping into it.
I hope posing for that wasn't too painful. And
oh no, not at all. I mean, basically posing for Clive, and you know, just standing around having your photograph taken.
Right.
So you know that it wasn't too bad at all.
Yeah.
So and then you know he just had reference photographs and you know got the and then just applied his imagination basically. So that's how. And then I'd known Clive for about 3 years before he just phoned up one day and saying, "I'm making a movie, Nick. I'd like you to be in it. There is some makeup involved." which I think Simon and I swear he used the same line on both of us, that there was some makeup involved,
right.
In Hellraiser, and that's basically how I got into movies. It's right, all true, Clive.
Right. Oh, that's good. That's interesting. I had no idea. Mm. But so what away from it all, I've seen some documentaries featuring him. There's a very there's a great one that shows you his studio, his painting studio where he lives. And just the stacks and stacks of paintings that he calls his failures, but they're better than some people. They're better than some people's first attempts. You know, I mean, you know.
He's extraordinary. I remember sitting in his studio. I'm fascinated by art. I dabble myself, right. And I remember sitting in his studio. And I was watching him paint. I said, "Oh, you're using a black. Why are you, you know, that's making it too dark. Surely that's too dark."
Yeah.
And he pointed out that this was just an under color.
Right.
And that he would paint over that color. I was like, "Yeah, shut up, Nick. Clive knows what he's doing."
Yeah.
He's amazing. But I think we have a program over here. We were watching it last night called Portrait Artist of the Year.
Okay.
Which is a competition where they and it's absolutely fascinating where
right.
they get 9 people in to paint 3 celebrities and you know it's an hour long program and you watch their progress. They get 4 hours to paint somebody.
Right. I think I've seen that actually. I think I've seen that, Joe.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely fascinating. Yeah. And
it's marvelous
they
to
just
see...
announced the winner yesterday.
Right. Yeah. It's marvelous to see each person's. Interpretation of essentially the same, you know.
Yeah,
it's not
absolutely
like
the same.
Yeah,
it's brilliant. They were showing last night the guy who'd won, who's painting Tom Jones, the singer Tom Jones for the National Museum in Wales, and they showed his process, and he showed all the countless sketches he'd done, but also the fact that basically he lays on the. You lay on the shadows first if you're painting in oils,
right.
And then you paint it and you do it in pencils as well. You put the darker colours in first and then you layer over the top to get the stuff. So, yeah, it's a fascinating thing. I love art. I was lucky enough to model for... as I modelled for Clive, I also modelled for Dave McKean for his book Cages... for an artist called John Bolton, a comics artist called John Bolton.
Yeah,
right. So I did quite a lot of modelling for artists back in the day, which is fun, really, really good fun.
Right. So obviously you do, you know, you've met Clive, you go and do a couple of Hellraiser pitches. At what point, now because you're sort of almost part of his players, if you will. Was it a natural step then to go and do Nightbreed?
Yeah, I think it was. I think you're absolutely right. Clive's career, you know, surrounded himself with this group. Because, I mean, most of the guys who were in the Dog Company went on to do the films.
Right.
I think Doug, Simon and I did all 3 of Clive's early directorial stuff before he did Lord of Illusions. So other Clive obviously didn't direct Hellbound. He was heavily involved because the reason he didn't do Hellbound was because he was preparing for Nightbreed.
Right. Yeah.
I think it was think, yes, it was a conversation saying, yeah, you know, we're going to be doing a third film. Well, you did have that feeling, you know, it was the part of the family.
Right.
I think that's one of the great things is that, oh God, over 30 years later,
yeah.
We're still meeting up. In fact, weekend after next, we're at Motor City Nightmares in Novi, near Detroit.
Right.
And Clive will be there, and Doug Bradley will be there, Ashley Lawrence will be there, Andrew Robinson from Hellraiser will be there, Doug Simon Barbie, you know, Barbie from Hellbound, Barbie Wild. And it is just like, you know, well, we're just meeting up with our mate, you know, you're meeting up with your mates apart from anything else.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, a couple of years ago, it came up on my Facebook feed, Barbie, myself, Simon, Ken Cranham, and Oliver Smith, who played skinned Frank in Hellraiser, we all did a movie called The Offer together. From Dead Mouse Productions, the guys behind the Leviathan documentary. But I think when we were doing Nightbreed, there was just a definite feeling, okay, yeah, the gang's all here again.
And Clive, I mean, his books are, you know, as phantasmagorical as his artwork. What is the man like away from all that? Like just sitting down with your mate, Clive.
The great thing about Clive is it's really intelligent conversation.
Right.
You have to, you know, I always feel as if I'm being slightly challenged to do my best and to think my hardest.
Right.
And it's lovely, which is incredibly stimulating, of course.
Yeah.
You know, it really makes you think, yeah, gosh, this is fun and I'm learning so much here.
Yeah.
And gosh, yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that before. And funny, I mean, he's very, very funny. Yeah. It was really lovely, actually. I was at Days of the Dead in Atlanta. Earlier this year, January of this year, there was a Clive, and I brought my original Hellraiser script across with me to get, because Clive had never signed it, and my manager, Chris, had just suggested I bring it across, so I did, and I managed to find Clive at his table at a fairly quiet patch, and then we ended up by having a chat for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was, again, it was just, I thought, oh my God, I've not really had that chance because, of course, Clive lives in Los Angeles, I live in London, so I really don't see much each other now except at conventions when we're busy.
Yeah.
So this is the first chance I had to have a really good chat with Clive, and I just thought, oh my God, this is just so wonderful. Because as I say, you always walk away feeling better about yourself because he's always so genuinely encouraged, and you feel challenged, and your mind it's kind of opened up to new thoughts and, you know, new ways of looking at things.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is with somebody like Clive, is you just get blown away by all these, of the way that your mind is being expanded and just by being in conversation with him.
Right, so did you read the book first or the script?
Cabal.
Yeah.
I suspect I did. Gosh, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I think I must have done, because I remember that originally in the book, the character who is with Peliquin when Boone first comes to Midian is called Jackie.
Yeah.
And who is described as having two faces melded into one, two brothers melded into one.
Right.
Now, they created that makeup, and in fact, you can see it at the top of the beginning of the movie.
Right.
But when Clive saw it, it's not going to work, because only one eye was working. You could only make one eye, and the other eye is obviously a false eye, and you just can't get any expression.
Right.
So the character was then changed to Kinski.
Yes.
No
relation to Klaus.
No relation to Klaus.
No.
Possibly related to Mac Tonight.
Right.
The McDonald's Crescent Moon Face guy.
Right.
Now, I don't know what the inspiration was, or you know, if that's what Clive had in the back of his mind when he you know, came up with this idea.
Right.
Suddenly it was changed. You know, I wasn't there when those were decisions. I was just told this is what your makeup's going to look like.
Right.
Nick, I didn't even get to see the original design for Jackie. Okay. I was literally, you know, the first makeup I saw was the one that everyone's familiar with, perhaps, the Kinski makeup with the crescent moon.
So you eventually, of course, read this, you know, whichever you read first, you read the material. You've worked with Clive before, so going into the making of the film, was it smooth because of the history you already had?
Smooth in some respects, not in others. Yeah. It was a fraught production, I think, as everyone knows. So when we first started, the original idea was that they wouldn't use the prosthetics.
Right.
And it would be much cheaper. Right. So I went to, I think it was probably Pinewood Studios, and I spent a day being painted, basically.
Right.
I remember standing around in a loincloth and people painting me.
Right.
To see what effects they could get and what they could achieve. And then having it all washed off me at the end of the day before I could go home.
Right.
And they felt, you know, it just doesn't work. They are gonna, you know, to get these fantastical creatures, you can't really do it without prosthetic makeup. Which of course increased the budget. Then what happened is that halfway through, Morgan Creek, the production company, which were run by two partners at the time.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, the cost, I think, was already ballooning on the movie.
Yeah.
And then the guy who'd actually commissioned the film, greenlit the film, left. So the other partner who hadn't commissioned and really didn't understand what Clive was trying to do, apparently,
yeah.
I think, you know, was just looking at the cost of this thing and thinking, they were expecting to get. No, I obviously wasn't. This is the stuff I've heard afterwards.
Right.
You know, they were expecting to get another Hellraiser, another horror movie. But here we have is a huge movie with more monsters than any other movie ever before at that time, and the monsters are the good guys.
Right.
So this is not what people are expecting,
and what the
producers are expecting. So it was really tough for Clive. It was a really tough time for Clive.
Yeah.
He ended up in a hospital because he fell down, and he was in hospital. I remember he was in hospital for a week or so towards the end of the shoot. So it just completed. He was a really a tough place by the time we'd finished doing it.
Yeah.
So. On the other hand, it was still the same gang. So Image Animation, the guys who were all the young men and young women who, and when I say young, literally they were in their late teens, early 20s, these amazingly talented makeup people who'd worked on both the first films. They brought in a whole new load of people because there were so many monsters to do. I was lucky enough, I'd worked with, guys who went on to win Oscars for their makeup, Mark Goulier, John Bormican has won an Emmy, Neil Gorton, who runs Millennium FX, who does all the modern Doctor Who TV series, creates all the monsters for that. I mean, a lot of people got their start with Image Animation, and a lot of people got their start on Nightbreed.
Right.
Extraordinary, you know, extraordinary bunch of talented people, worked so hard. I just had to sit in a makeup chair. These big guys are on their feet all day, applying makeup, painting, creating, doing all the really tough stuff.
Yeah.
So then they were there. The crew was the same as well. The cameraman was doing Robin Vigen.
Yes.
The sound guy was the same. A lot of the guys, you know, who'd worked on the first two films, harking back to what you were saying before, Clive built up a really good team that worked.
Yeah.
So he kept on using them. And that was true until he moved to the States.
Right. When I watch the film now, it strikes me that it was kind of like Guillermo del Toro before Guillermo del Toro, you know. He's a big, not only he likes a lot of monsters in his movies, but he likes that practical people in masks and real stuff on the set, very little CGI where possible.
Yes.
And Nightbreed sort of strikes me as that kind of thing before. I mean, now that Del Toro's done it and done it successfully several times, you know, he's the standard bearer, but Nightbreed was kind of that before, you know, before it was popular now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Nightbreed is just an extraordinary film. Clive describes it as Gone with the Wind with monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
A huge romantic film.
Mm.
You know, that it's... I think that's... One of the things to remember about Hellraiser, Hellbound, and Nightbreed, at the core of them, they are love stories, very twisted love stories in the case of Hellraiser and Hellbound.
Yeah.
Nightbreed is a story about a woman and what she'll do for the man she loves. Yeah. You know, the sacrifices she will make, what she will do, and I think that's what a lot of Clive's work is about, passion and sex and sexuality and so on.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, and I think obviously, of course, you know, in terms of practicality, there was no CGI when we were making Hellraiser. It was all practical effects. Right. It had all to be practical.
Yes.
You know, CGI, well, it was kind of... I mean, it's not that it didn't exist, because they made Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So it was in its early days.
Yeah.
But, you know, the reason why you get away with it in Roger Rabbit is because you're doing cartoons and live action. You're mixing, which obviously they'd done before with Mary Poppins, but in terms of thinking about realistic-looking CGI, you know, that just didn't exist in those days.
Yeah. But did you happen to run into Mr. Cronenberg, who was in the film?
Only in makeup and only once.
Okay, later. Right.
So yeah. He has no idea what I look like.
Right.
Though I do remember. I do remember him. We were. I was in the College Door at Pinewood. We filmed this at Pinewood Studios, and Peter Atkins, who wrote Hellbound, Hellraiser 3, again was part of the Dog Company. Was at school. Friend of Clive's, and so, you know, that's still a very good friend of Clive's. I was walking along the corridor, and Pete just said, Nick, come here. Okay, listen here. And he got me to listen at a door, and we could hear a typewriter going along. And he said, that's David Cronenberg typing up the script of his next film, which was the name of which entirely escapes me. Now?
Right.
Oh, God. It was a David Cronenberg film. Naked Lunch.
Wow, okay.
He was saying, yeah, he's typing up the script for Naked Lunch.
Wow.
We were blown away by that. So that's the closest I got to Mr. Cronenberg, but from all accounts, he was really cool.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed working with him.
Yeah, I think ironically perfect casting in that part that he played, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
It's a wonder he didn't go on. I mean, he has played little parts in other movies before and since.
Yeah.
He strikes me as, you know, you just... I often wonder with... Because you know yourself, with being an actor, you put yourself... You know, you're essentially putting yourself in someone else's shoes to play a part.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of the process as well. And, of course, with film acting, you're also... I mean, this is the real difference. You were talking about Berkoff earlier on, the difference between film acting and theatre.
Yeah.
With theatre, you are 90% in control of what the audience sees.
Yeah.
Film it kind of the other way round. Yeah. You're only about 30 or 40% in control. The rest of it is to do with the film and the editor, and the makeup and the setting and the camera and the lighting, etc. And you never get to see your audience. You know, you don't get to meet the audience until after the event. And you may end up in the cutting room floor. It's happened to me. Perfectly good performance, but it just doesn't work for the movie.
Yeah.
That's just the way it works. That's what filmmaking is about.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, you may have to read, you know, you'd give a wonderful performance and say, okay, go again. We need, something happened. You know, we had a plane flew overhead or, you know, whatever. Mm. So it's a very different experience from being, you know, from being theatre. Mm. I mean, I was lucky in all the three movies I made with Clive that it all worked.
Yes.
It all massively worked. I think the great thing with Kinski as opposed to Chashra, of course, is there was an awful lot more to do.
Yes.
A lot more lines, and it was just, you know, there was a lot more interaction with the other characters, and, you know, you kind of felt you were acting more. So it was a more pleasurable experience.
Yes. In talking about the sort of the Del Toro connection as far as movies with monsters. Ron Perlman, I regard as one of the great actors able to act through several layers of prosthetics. What was your experience acting through a lot of makeup? Is it easier or difficult to act with all that stuff on your face?
It's really interesting. I mean, the other person, of course, is Doug Jones.
Yes, yeah, well, Doug Jones.
And again, with Del Toro. Funnily enough, a quick aside, I was at a convention with Doug Jones. I was at Dragon Con in Atlanta a few years ago, and suddenly looked at us and said, oh my God, you've both played moon-faced guys.
Right.
Because Doug Jones did the original Mac Tonight advertising campaign in America. For those of you who don't know, Mac Tonight was a tap dancing. So basically, he looked like Fred Astaire, but his head was a crescent moon.
Right.
Wearing sunglasses.
Right.
So I think it's interesting. I mean, how's it different? You feel. And I haven't acted recently under makeup.
Yeah.
What you very quickly learned is that it's very responsive, because the thing is with, compare the two, Chatterer and Kinski.
Right.
So Chatterer is a mask. It's not attached to my face. Literally all I can do is walk, chatter, and shove my fingers down Ash's throat, and that's it, you know, and stay still.
Yes.
And actually what we learned very quickly was, I mean, it was just purely because I didn't really have very much choice, discovered that actually walking chattering is that the makeup is so strong, the image of Chatterer is so strong, it's mind-blowing. And, the whole thing about Chatterer, people often say that he's scarier than Pinhead, because you can't have a dialogue. You can't bargain with Chatterer.
Yeah.
But Chatterer's just going to fuck you up.
Right.
And, you know, there's no reasoning with him. Yeah. He is just going to do what he wants to do.
Yes.
Kinski is a complete opposite. I mean, Kinski's a wannabe bad guy. He hangs around with Pellequin, who's obviously the really bad guy.
Right.
But Kinski's is a much gentler soul than Pellequin.
Yes.
And in terms of acting through the makeup, really it was just acting, and it becomes a lot of that, you know, the eyes are where you look.
Yeah.
You get the expression. I have to say, it's not my voice in the original release.
Right.
I was overdubbed with an American accent.
Yeah.
Later on, they did try.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was about to say.
You hear my voice.
Yeah.
On the Cabal cut in some places.
Right.
But I think, you know, that's the thing. Is you have. So you. Which comes back to the early conversation about, you know, it's out of your hands, kind of. But in terms of the intention and the spirit and what is it, you know, your portrayal, it's just acting still. And I think because in the Kinski makeup, so the point I was trying to make is that it was stuck to my skin.
Right.
So whenever I moved my face, it responded.
Okay. So if you smile, if you...
Yeah, if you smile, if you're worried, but but there again, it's all about the body, and you inhabit. You mentioned this earlier on. you're inhabiting a character.
Yeah.
You are that character.
Yeah.
You've made your decisions as to what the situation is, what does he want,
yeah.
What's he trying to achieve in this scene, and who he is. You know all the, you've made up your mind a long time before you walk on set as yeah. to who this guy is.
Yes.
In your own mind, and then you're going to discuss. We discuss with Clive on the set what it is Clive wants.
Yeah.
And then you've got to be aware of technically what's required.
Yeah.
I remember I fucked up one scene because I didn't follow instructions in terms of where I was supposed to be running.
Right.
Because I thought I knew better.
Right.
Don't do that anymore. I never think I know better than the people telling me what to do on a film set.
Right.
I know I'm always wrong. Unless I'm the director,
yeah.
In which case I'm right. when you're acting, Clive said, in some aspects, all that's required from an actor is obedience.
Yeah.
And it's true in some, it's a very technical thing. You've got to hit your mark. You've got to be in the right place. You've got to do it repeatedly.
Yeah.
So that you get, the cameraman can get his shot, you're in focus, you've hit the, you're lit properly.
Yeah.
All that stuff is going on in your head, as well as trying to remember the lines and bring some character and some emotion to whatever's going on.
Yeah.
It's no different from acting in without makeup in that respect. It's just you have to get up. You have to have a lot more stamina, I think.
Yeah.
Because, I was there at, I went into makeup chair at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
So I was picked up at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So makeup chair, 4 o'clock in the morning,
yeah.
After 5 hours of makeup.
Yeah.
On set at 9 o'clock. Now,
oh, wow.
As I say, that's tough, and you have to keep on going all. I think I did 16-hour day.
Yeah.
On some reshoots, I did a 16-hour day,
yeah.
And that, which is tough. That's hard work. But as I say, the guys actually creating the makeup have it tougher because they're on. While you're sitting in this chair, having to stay still,
yeah.
They are on their feet. They're applying it. They've got to make sure it looks good.
Yeah.
And these are the same guys who are going to have painted the makeup. And in Kinski's case, of course, it's applied the wig, applied the eyebrow, applied the beard, and all that stuff. So these were really, really hardworking.
Was it
young men?
Was it heavy on your face?
No. It's probably about the same weight as a bathroom sponge.
Okay, right. I just wondered
Latex foam. Yeah. Latex foam rubber in those days. Though these days they mostly use silicone, I believe.
Yeah.
So, and I've not had the chance to, no one's asked me to do that. I'd love to wear makeup again and do the makeup part. Because
yeah,
they're fun, I love work. I admire the artistic talent of all these guys who do this makeup, guys and girls, who do this makeup.
Yes.
They're extraordinary. Because it's not just imagining it. They have to sculpt it. They have to paint it. They have to apply it. Extraordinary, absolutely amazing people, and really interesting to chat to. I made some really good friends, Jeff Poitras, Roy Puddyford, and John Cormack, and guys who I occasionally see, over 30 odd years ago.
Yeah.
I don't get to see them as frequently as the cast because they don't come with us to conventions.
Right.
They have their own makeup conventions,
yeah.
Rather than actor conventions.
Yes, yes. But it's a real thrill to talk to you because Kinski is my favourite character in the film, oddly enough.
Because, oh, wow!
Yeah.
Thank you.
Because, it's weird. It started off like the first time I ever saw it. For me, he's the most striking visually. Just the look. I'm not just saying it's because of the face or anything like that. But, like you said, he starts off Like he's trying to you know, run with the bad boy, as you say, and trying to say, look, I can be bad too, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But sort of through that, he then defends Boone and then tries to help him escape.
Yeah.
And then when we skip forward a little bit, when Boone is being admitted into the you know, the tribes of the moon and all that sort of
thing. Yeah, yeah.
He is the one who sort of stands for him, votes for him, if you will. You
yeah,
know? And there's a scene that it's one of my favorite scenes, because the look on your face is almost this look of pride, like you're proud that he is taking his place, you know, almost like I always like to think in my mind though, he, you know, might have had some sort of foresight that Boone was going to be the guy who was going to be the, you know, the savior or the chosen one or whoever, whatever you want to call it. And there's that great scene where you have this, you're behind Craig Schaefer, but you've got this look of, like, you know, it's almost a regal sort of like, I'm so proud to be doing this. Sort of, you know, to be inducting this person into the club, if you will. And it's just, you know, it's just and just the striking, and you know, it always just sort of stuck. And even when I watched it again last night to, you know, for a refresher before we chatted. But it's a little bit of a long time.
Well, thank you.
I
love that scene as well, and I loved playing Kinski. Yeah. I love playing Kinski.
Yeah.
I mean, I love that, you know, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
He has, Clyde gave me one of the best lines I think I've ever had.
Yeah.
He unmade Midian. I just think, you know, he didn't destroy it. He unmade Midian.
Yeah.
I think it's such a beautifully written line. I think this is the thing about Kinski, and I think one of the things that's lovely about him, so you have Pellequin, wonderfully played by Oliver Parker. Removal man in the first Hellraiser and the second Hellraiser, and then plays Pellequin in Nightbreed. He was great fun to work with.
He's got the iconic sort of trailer line, you know, God's an astronaut and Oz is the rainbow and Midian's where the monsters live.
Oh, it gives me a chill when you quote it. It's a one. That's the great thing about working on Clive's films. You know, any actor who's got those lines, just amazing.
Yes.
You know, we lucky enough that Andrew Robinson has come to been to a few conventions, and we've done question and answers with Andrew Robinson.
Yes.
And listening to his stories as to why he did Hellraiser.
Right.
And Andrew's an amazing guy, talented guy, gone on to do all the TV series and the Star Trek stuff, and so on, under a lot of makeup. You just have these wonderful lines. Again, if you go back to Hellraiser, those victims that Julia brings back, I like to be careful, says one of them just before he's bludgeoned to death with a hammer. But also in Nightbreed, just brilliant script, brilliant dialogue.
Yeah. There's so many different versions floating around out there. I guess a good question. Personal favourite? Did you like the theatrical version? Are you a fan of the director's cuts or the Cabal cut? Or, you know, have you seen all the different ones or not? Or
I have. Yeah. No. Yep. Funnily enough, I've seen all of them so far.
Yep.
And there's a fourth one that they're now working on.
Yeah.
A 3-hour version.
Right.
Which I keep on coming up on my timeline, which I believe is coming out from Morgan Creek. They found yet more
footage. Yeah.
So you get to see a lot more monsters.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to see what becomes of this? Or yeah, I don't know much more about it rather than the fact that there's a Facebook page and they've announced it and they're working, and they, every so often they release previously unseen photographs.
Right. So is it, I guess a good question, is there anything in particular you remember filming that still hasn't been put in the film or included?
I don't remember, because the scene that was missing from the theatrical cut, which was then put back into both Cabal, I think, and the director's cut is the one between myself and Pellequin, where Pellequin's talking to Kinski, saying, you know, you think, you know, okay, you blame me, or something along the lines of, this isn't my fault, and Kinski obviously blames Pellequin, and Pellequin then rushes out and decides to, you know, rush to the surface and confront bazookas and trucks and so on. That one was put back in. That was definitely missing from the theatrical version.
Yeah.
I mean, there was so much missing from the theatrical version, basically, it was re-edited into and reshot to be a stalk and slash movie, which is not what the original script was about.
The original script
was, as I say, was a love story, much like the book is a love story, with monsters. So I find it amazing that, as I say, there's potentially a fourth version. Yeah. Of it. I think it's fascinating. I'm really interested to see what they put back in.
Because before I actually saw the film, I found a book, and it's like an illustrated version of the screenplay.
Oh, the script.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it has photos and drawings and the screenplay in it.
Yes.
And to read that screenplay, which was obviously. I don't know whether it was the shooting script probably a very close draft to what they used.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe so. Funnily enough, there was another. I'm looking at it on my bookshelf as we talk. My very battered copy of it. And then I've got. Interesting. Okay. There's a book missing from my bookshelf, and I'm wondering where else I've put that. Because there was another book done called The Nightbreed Chronicles, which is basically you had a photograph and a brief biography, which Clive wrote after we'd finished filming, I should say. Because I remember reading it, getting a copy of it afterwards and thinking, wish I'd known this stuff before we started.
Your character,
which is a really fascinating book as well, which proved really interesting when I went on to, but really useful when I went on to write Nightbreed comics for Marvel, Epic Comics as part of Marvel, because I'd written Hellraiser comics and I wrote Nightbreed comics as well. And so that proved incredibly useful, that book, because I had all these characters that had not been, that were visible in the film, but which you never got to know their backstory. And of course, there's still talk. Now, I don't know what's happening with it now, but since all the change at Fox and Disney and so on, but there's been talk for a long time. You know, they announced a Nightbreed TV series.
Oh, okay.
So, now, no idea what's going on with that at the moment, but you know, since Disney took over Fox, whether or not that's affected, you know, so much is up in the air in Hollywood at the moment.
It might be a good reason to get the gang back together.
It'd be wonderful if they can get a few of us over there, because I assume they're going to film. I don't know where they're going to film. I have no idea. They could be filming in Europe. They could be filming anywhere. No idea what's going on. There is such a rich. I think this is the thing about the book Cabal and the film Nightbreed, is there is such a rich seam of stuff to mine.
Yeah, sure.
There are extraordinary There are so many characters and so many backstories and so many stories to be told in within that world. Yeah. I really do hope the TV series gets off, takes off.
But I mean, the big story that I always heard to come out of it after I started reading about, the production and how it was a turbulent production, was the fact that the opening of the film, that scene where Babette shows the girl the past, she touches her and she has visions of the past. I read somewhere that was a major scene. That was supposed to open the movie. That, it's going to be like the... I think it's in that script, in that book that we both have.
Yes.
It opened, and that was going to set the, set the scene. And it was like you saw how these people were persecuted and executed.
Yes.
It was a much longer, larger, elaborate sequence. It was obviously that was obviously cut down to the scene as it exists. So I was always intrigued because you read that script in the book we have, and hopefully other people get a chance to see it, because that is you read that script and go, wow, if only they'd left him alone and given him some more money, that would have been, because there's stuff in that script that's not in any of the films, and it would be just incredible to see it.
Yes, and of course it may have been shot, and you may see it in the three-hour version.
That's true, they might pull it all back together, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think the thing is, of course, that if the film had started with that, that would have definitely made it the Nightbreed story.
Yeah.
The story of the monsters rather than the story of Boone and Laurie.
Yeah.
But by making this the dream of Boone, this introduces our hero, and it works and so on.
Yeah.
But it would have given a very different slant.
Another question I've been dying to ask you, and it's partly inspired by my wife too. Craig Schaefer, who you played some scenes with, I don't know whether you know this or not, but his first film was a science fiction rock opera comedy called Voyage of the Rock Aliens. Have you ever heard of it?
Never heard of it.
Oh, well, look, do yourself a favour. When you're done with me, if you've got the time... Look it up on the internet or YouTube. Voyage of the Rocket. It was his first ever picture that he was in, and I just wondered what he was like, because Nightbreed was Nightbreed like was the next thing he did, wasn't it? Or was it pretty close? It was pretty close to the next thing he did.
I think it was his first leading role.
Major
production. He's a lovely, he's a really, really nice guy. I've met him a couple of times since.
Right.
He's a very talented actor.
Yes.
Craig. And Bobby, for example, who, Clive is always really good at finding very talented cast. He is a lovely guy. He certainly didn't mention that movie whenever I remember talking to him. I remember after we made Nightbreed, I had enough money to go to the States for the first time.
Right.
And I flew into New York, met up with Anne Bobby, and then flew on. Oh no, I missed Anne Bobby because she was away filming in Canada doing some more stuff, and then I met up with her sister, and then I went over to Los Angeles and hooked up with some friends of mine who I'd been at drama school with, a lady called Holly, who I'd been at drama school with. And I remember walking along Venice Beach and literally talking about the fact that what was weird was not bumping into people I know, because I was on the other side of the world. And literally just as I'd said that, I hear Nick. turn around, that's Craig Sheffer.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
Who's happened to be on the beach, talking to me. So it really is a small world as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. But yeah, check it out, Voyage of the Rock Aliens.
Voyage of the Rock Aliens.
Yeah, Voyage of the Rock Aliens.
That sounds wonderful.
It is.
Sounds wonderful.
You know how they say some films are released and other films escape? That one planted, escaped, and got over the wall and hasn't been seen since. Yeah,
right.
It's the most unique film I've ever seen. Never to be repeated. And that was his first.
Right.
That was his first movie. So, yeah. So it was. It was all. It was all uphill from there. Yeah, it's fantastic. Look, it might look stupid, but if you ever get the chance to watch it, you'll be rewarded. Because it is just so vivacious and intriguing, and just it's everything that was beautiful and wrong about the 80s.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, check
yes,
it out.
Yes, there was a lot in that camp. Yeah.
Check it out. But one question I always ask is any amusing tales from the set that have not been heard? Anything that
probably you... not. To be honest, I've been talking about these things for over 30. At least in the last 20 odd years or so, because it really didn't kick off until about 10 years after we finished.
Right,
I think the 10th anniversary. It was the first convention. The 10th anniversary of Hellraiser was the first convention that I did. As well as playing Kinski, I'm uncredited as a berserker. The one with glowing eyes, the white, the paler of the four berserkers, I played those. I remember standing at the top of some scaffolding. It was a huge set in Midian.
Yes.
And Laurie gets her ankle grabbed by one of the berserkers as she goes down the corridor.
Yeah.
And originally we tried it with me, but they decided my arm was too pale, the arm I was with, so they got one of the other guys to do it. But whilst we were filming it, I remember being at the top of some scaffolding underneath the set with Anne Bobby, who plays Laurie, staring down at me, and then somebody grabbing my hand, and we'd already become friends at this stage. And she just looked down at me, grabbed my hand, and started singing, "You made me love you. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it."
That's great. That's fantastic. Oh, that's wonderful. That's lovely.
Good friends with Anne Bobby. Wonderful, talented woman.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, look, Nicholas, I've taken up way too much of your time. Thank you for schooling me in the lore, according to Nicholas Vince, my favourite character, ladies and gentlemen, from Nightbreed, who played Kinski. He's been a bit of a hellraiser as well, but
absolutely.
Yeah, but I hope, mate, that if they do something else regarding Nightbreed, whether on the small screen or the big screen, I hope they give you a call. Because it would be a real thrill, surely for yourself, but for fans and certainly myself, to see you back playing a familiar.
Well, thank you very much. And I should just say before we go that on May the 11th in the United Kingdom, in Bournemouth in the United Kingdom, I'm introducing a 35 screening of the original print of Nightbreed on 35mm,
well,
the actual film.
There you go.
At the Mary Shelley Theatre on May the 11th, I'm going to be introducing that and doing a Q&A about that. So really looking forward to doing that.
I wish I could be there, but I'm a bit far away.
Anyone, any listeners over in the UK, if you hear this football, come on down.
Excellent. Yep, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. And look, Nick, if you're ever down under, doing the same sort of thing, or even just down under for a holiday, You know where to find me. Give us a bell and we'll have a beer and,
That would be great.
And talk shop.
That would be great.
All right, mate. Thank you very much for being on the show and take care of yourself, mate.
Will do.
All right. Bye. Cheers.